Hi, I'm Jane Lindholm. I'm the host of Vermont Edition, and I just wanted to let you know that this podcast has been edited for brevity. Thanks for listening.
This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. Today we're going to hear several stories about local responses to COVID-19, the illness caused by the new coronavirus. In a little while, small business owners looking for creative approaches to the potential of lost work, and the confusion one local family feels about why they're not being tested for COVID-19, despite symptoms and a travel history they think would make them prime candidates for testing. First, we wanted to know more about how the testing for this disease actually works. Dartmouth-Hitchcock Medical Center is in the process of developing its own proprietary test right now. Ed Marins is Chief Clinical Officer for the Dartmouth-Hitchcock Health System. He's part of the incident command team managing DHMC's response to the coronavirus outbreak. When I spoke with him on Tuesday, Dr. Marins walked me through the current testing procedure.
The basics of it are that the testing that is done uses a swab that samples cells from the nose and the mouth. In medicine, we call that the nasopharyngeal and oral region. We have to make complicated names for everything. So it's sampling cells and from those areas, so the mouth and the nose, at a time when someone is symptomatic. And this is really important. The tests that we have from the CDC and are not validated in people that don't have symptoms. So someone has symptoms, they have a good story, they traveled, they've been exposed, they have fever, cough, shortness of breath, any of that. We sample those areas. Those swabs contain cells from the body, as well as what we hope to detect would be the viral genetic material, which is called RNA. And so what happens is that is sent to a lab like the state lab, and we can talk a little bit about what we're doing here, that has some ability to recognize that genetic code or that genetic signature for that virus based on that RNA, which is the kind of building blocks genetic code that is unique to this coronavirus. So what is done is that there are certain probes that can turn positive when it detects the virus from this sample. So that's what happens at the state lab, which is a test developed by the CDC when we send a test there.
And so, you know, that's what you've been doing. You've been able to test, and hospitals around the country and around our region have been able to test and then initially send things to the CDC, now send things to a state lab. Why is Dartmouth-Hitchcock developing its own test? What's the benefit?
I think it allows us to supplement our ability to work with the state. This isn't a dissatisfaction with the state or not anything that we would find that would be positive we would send to the state for confirmatory testing. It just allows us, as I think we want to be able to expand our ability to test, it allows us to do that on our own. We know that the production of testing kits from the CDC was a little bit behind, and states have had to get additional test kits, and New Hampshire has obtained more, as Vermont has as well. But it allows us to kind of run tests a little bit quicker and allows us to make some decisions about testing. We are now testing people with suspected illness and symptoms. We want sometimes to expand that and make sure that we're also being very cautious about how we test other people that might present. It just allows us the ability to test more people, and it allows us to do it in-house and allows us to do it faster. There are commercial labs that are allowing testing right now, but the turnaround time can be up to 4 days. There's a big push. Many of these labs are in California, and there's a big push, and they're receiving a lot of tests from the West Coast where there's been a big impact of this disease. So some of this is just timing. Some of this is just the expertise that our lab is capable of, and there's a lot of in-house testing that we do that we've developed, and this just is emblematic of our expertise that we want to apply to this disease. It's important, and we have the capability.
So what does it actually entail to develop your own test? Are you kind of taking the CDC test and copying it, or do you do something different?
It's so I can't necessarily tell you the exact methods that we're using, not because they're proprietary. I'm not the person to answer all those specific questions. But what we are doing, what we've done in collaboration with the state, is that we've obtained the RNA, the genetic material from the four positives in the state. And we've been able to obtain this genetic material from the virus that they've given to us to allow to calibrate our probes to develop our tests. So they've given us kind of the source material to be able to develop our own tests. That'll be key. So now we know what the right lineup of proteins are in the genetic code. We can develop our probes, and then we can go and do some testing.
So when you say this testing will allow you to get results faster, is the test itself, are you getting the results faster than a different lab would? Is this, are you developing essentially a rapid test? Or is it just that the turnaround time is faster because you don't have to send it out and then wait?
I think it's primarily the latter. We're not developing something that's a rapid test like you can have done while you wait in the waiting room. It still requires the same degree of scientific rigor and lab protocol. It's just that we're able to do it locally, in-house, and efficiently. And that's what major medical centers and academic medical centers do. We do the same for much of our lab services that we now coordinate and provide across our Dartmouth-Hitchcock Health System and member hospitals. So this is just another service that we can provide. There are a lot of hospitals that rely on send-outs that take several days to come back, and we have tests that can come back within the same day, and we're applying the same to this important health need.
So you think it would be same day, within 24 hours, within 12 hours? What's the thinking?
I think that we would probably be able to provide test results within 24 hours. We may be able to do it sooner. You know, we are working with a state now that is running their tests twice a day. There's no reason that we could not get to a point where we're doing testing with the same degree of accuracy and timeliness.
What's the cost to develop this test, and how do you weigh that?
It involves people time, the experts in this field doing the work. It involves purchasing probes and reagents and the equipment to be able to do this. I think we have a lot of this material. You know, we are committed to mobilizing resources to address this across our system, whether it's staffing, protective equipment, changing our inpatient environments, enabling our ambulatory clinics. So this just falls into the spectrum of what we are deeply committed to address this in our region and serving as an example for all.
You said that this test, if you have it in-house, should allow you to make different choices about who actually gets tested. Do you have a protocol that you're developing for that, who might get tested, who wouldn't otherwise?
We're working on protocols right now. We are testing people in collaboration with the state, and we're focusing on people that have specific risk factors. They travel to an area, one of the CDC categorized regions, where we know that we have the coronavirus present, or they've had contact with a known positive and they have symptoms. So we've been going by that. But even from the CDC's own standpoint, there may be people that present with reasonable symptoms that it might be reasonable to test just so we can understand the spread of this disease in other communities. And we may get to that point. We're not talking about testing people, everyone for this disease, or testing asymptomatic people, but we may want to be able to test people in a more expedited fashion that allows us to utilize our resources better. So if someone comes in and they're suspected and we can test them and be able to rule out this disease within 24 hours, it means we can go through the whole process of decontaminating a room and getting the next person in there. So this allows us to use our resources in a way that allows us to take care of more people.
You mentioned that currently the test only works on people who are exhibiting symptoms already. Is there a way to test for people who are either asymptomatic because they haven't started showing symptoms yet, or who may have had the virus in the past, and you could be able to test for that to see who has had it if it was a mild version that they never got treated for?
That's a great question. So you're talking about two different things. You're talking about the so we don't have the ability, what we know about the CDC test is that it is only validated for people that have symptoms. And we think that's because, you know, when you have a viral illness and the virus is really active and is disrupting the membranes in your nose and your mouth, that's when it's most easily detectable. Now, so that's what it's validated for. The other test you're talking about is a test in which you could look at someone's immunity and to see if someone's had an immune response. We do this, for example, in, healthcare workers that have been immunized for hepatitis B. We look at their titers of immunity against a different kind of virus. We have not been, I'm not aware of looking at antibody testing for people that have this coronavirus, but that may come down the line. We're just not, it's not a part of our current plan or protocol. I'm sure there's more that will be developed as we move on. Remember, the whole concept of developing a vaccine, which we think, according to experts, is a year to year and a half out, is developing exposure to something that looks like the virus so your body can develop the immunity to mount against exposure if they were to encounter the virus.
Dr. Ed Marens is Chief Clinical Officer and part of the Incident Command Team managing the Dartmouth-Hitchcock Health System's response to the coronavirus outbreak. The hospital is in the process now of internal validation and testing, which Dr. Marens says is likely to take about 2 weeks. That testing should give the hospital a better idea of when and how to roll out the test for patient use. This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. Today on the show, experiences and information about dealing with the new coronavirus. People who think they may have come in contact with the virus are worried about when and how to get tested. Yesterday, I spoke with one Vermonter who is sick and is concerned about the strict testing protocol the state has implemented.
My name is Seth Jensen, and I'm a teacher at a high school in Chittenden County. I have two daughters and a wife from Spain.
You've been traveling. You went to Spain to visit one of your daughters who was studying in Spain. And that's when this story begins. Can you take us to Spain with you?
We went to visit my daughter, who is a sophomore in high school. She was studying in Madrid, living with some relatives and going to a private school. And the plan was for her to be there for 3 months through the 22nd of March. So when we got to Spain, nobody was really talking about COVID-19 in Europe at all. And actually, when we first got there, there were only two cases in Spain. By the time we were ready to leave on the 3rd of March, there were 153 cases. So people were starting to talk about it. But we were sick in Spain. My wife, my other daughter, who's a freshman in high school, and I all had cold, flu-like symptoms. And we basically thought that we were just feeling bad and that we would get better. We got back to the United States on Tuesday, March 3rd, and I was going to stay out of school the next day and go see the doctor to see how I was doing and if there's anything I could do to get better. And that's when we found out that there was a known case at my daughter's school in Madrid, Spain.
So what did you do then? Did you call your doctor?
We called our doctor as well as our doctor's pediatrician. And essentially, we explained the story that we had a daughter who was in the school as well as a couple nieces in the school of somebody who had tested positive for COVID-19. And there was kind of some conflicting messages about what we should do. We were told kind of to stay at home. We were also told that we could go to the emergency room if we needed to. And we spoke with our pediatrician. They checked out our daughter. They said that she was asymptomatic. And then through the Department of Health, we were told that she could go back to school because she was asymptomatic. And so what we decided to do was to not take that advice. And we were at that point, we're really trying to push for being tested. And we were kind of bounced back and forth between the health department and our primary care provider. And so what we did essentially was decide to stay in a quarantine as we were talking with our healthcare provider.
What does your healthcare provider think? Would that doctor like you to be tested?
Yes. Several times she said that she believes that we should be tested given the fact that we were possibly within one step of being in contact with somebody that is a known case in Spain. But we've since found out that we can't be tested because we don't meet the criteria which the UVM Health Network laid out, and that is along the same guidelines of the CDC, which is basically you either need hospitalization, excuse me, or you need to have traveled to a level three country, or have direct contact with a known case and symptoms consistent with the COVID-19. And so we didn't meet any of those criteria really, other than the symptoms, because Spain at that point had only had maybe 200 to 300 cases. And now Spain is number five on the list of most cases in the world at over 3,000.
And you think you may have been in contact. You know, you were in the same area potentially in terms of the school group with somebody who's a confirmed case, but you don't have evidence that you specifically shook the hand or stood near that specific person.
That's right. This was a four-year-old at the same school where my daughter was attending, as well as my two nieces. One of my nieces is 5 years old, so she sometimes comes into contact with that student's class, but we couldn't obviously make the connection directly.
And none of that was compelling enough to either the UVM Health Network or to the health department to relax the protocol in your case or to test you just to be on the safe side?
No, we were told by the health department that our primary care physician could authorize it, which is somewhat true, but not the full, not complete information, because we have to go through that next piece of not only our primary care physician saying that we should be tested, but the network and UVM saying that we needed to be tested, and we don't follow those guidelines at all.
So what would you like to see? You know, you mentioned to me when you and I spoke last night in setting this up that it's a hard thing to come forward and to reveal who you are and the fact that you're feeling ill, you know, and the potential stigma that comes attached with that or fear. But you think it's worth it because why? What is it that you're hoping to illuminate?
Well, I think that there are a couple of things here. One is clearly our health. We were very concerned about our health last week when we got back and learned about the case in my daughter's school. But also, more importantly, we're concerned about public health and our community's health. And being a teacher and having two daughters in high school, we didn't think it was responsible at all to put ourselves back in the community. And we think that the only way to get something like this under control is to get as much information as possible. And that begins with testing. And, you know, even though we didn't fit into the guidelines of being tested, we feel like we were at a pretty high risk of possibility. So we would like testing to be relaxed. We would like people to also take this seriously and not take things into their own hands in the sense of going out in the public when they might be ill, because clearly things are changing by the minute, and things that were talked about by the experts last week have changed to different topics this week. So I think we need to err on the side of caution, but I also feel like people need to start being tested in order to really get this under control.
And just to be clear here for people who didn't hear it, since you arrived home from Spain, you have not gone to work in the school system where you work. Your wife has not gone to work, and your two children have not gone to their schools. So in a sense, you have taken things into your own hands in going further than was recommended or required of you in terms of making sure that you were not out in the general population.
That's right. We did not follow the recommendation of sending our daughters to school, even though they were asymptomatic, because in our minds, if by chance we do have COVID-19 and our daughters are here at the house with us, it seems illogical to send them back out into the public when they could also be exposed, if in fact we do have it, which is unclear at this point. So we have decided to do things against the grain in the hope that we would protect more people without the knowledge of really knowing if we have it or not.
How are you and your family feeling? And, you know, when do you decide when it's appropriate to go back to work?
Well, we are feeling better. That's the upside to all of this. We still do have a bit of a cold. We've had this for about 2 weeks, but we've been told by our primary care physician that we should stay out for 2 weeks. And so that puts us into next week to be able to go back to work.
After speaking with Seth Jensen about his family's situation yesterday, I talked with Deputy Health Commissioner Tracy Dolan about some of the concerns Jensen raised. Dolan said the health department does have specific protocol for who is advised and allowed to get a COVID-19 test, but family doctors are the first link in that chain.
We rely on the physicians to refer tests to us. So anyone who's had a travel history and has exposure to a confirmed case, we would certainly recommend that they, and they have symptoms, we certainly recommend that they check in with their doctor. And if the doctor deems fit to see them based on the symptoms that they're hearing about, they do that. And then based on the physician's assessment, we determine whether or not the person should be tested. And so that's what we've been advising people. So people who have a severe acute symptom, such as shortness of breath, we recommend that they go directly to the hospital. But for all others, we recommend if they're having symptoms that are significant, that they call their physician and go through that channel.
And what Seth told me is that his physician does think that he and his wife should be tested. They do have symptoms. They were in a known area with COVID-19, and they may have been exposed to a person who has a confirmed case. But their physician says she cannot test them because they do not fall within UVM's protocol, and UVM says it can't test because of the health department protocol.
Yes, so we have a pretty clear protocol. We also have a pretty wide piece in there that refers to physician discretion. And we talk to the physician, and if the physician is able to make a case and say, hey, we really think this person should be tested, we do. So I can't really speak to whether or not one physician wants to test, but that somehow our lab has denied that. I'm not familiar with that case, and I'm not familiar that has happened. And so again, I can't really speak to the specifics of this case, but I can say that when physicians are recommending someone be tested, sometimes we chat with them and say, hey, let's walk through it. But for the most part, physicians who are saying, hey, I'm seeing these symptoms, I have a concern, I know what the history is, please test, we have been testing.
More broadly speaking, what we know or what we're being told about this virus is that not everyone who has it is showing severe symptoms. So it may be more widespread than our testing shows and that our confirmed testing shows. So is there a value? I mean, we have capacity to test more than we are. Why are we not testing sort of at our capacity?
That's a great question. The capacity goes across the healthcare system and into the lab. So we have a healthcare system that's stressed right now. We have limited test kits across the country, almost every state. And public health lab is experiencing some shortage, recognizing that we need to be thoughtful about who we're testing right now. So if we were more prepared, I think, as a country, we may have been ready for more widespread testing. But given what the CDC has guided, given our testing kits available, and given the capacity of our current healthcare system, we have to make choices. And right now, our choices are about symptomatic patients who meet a certain criteria, recognizing that there may be more out in the community, but we have to work on priorities right now.
In a sense, are you then stockpiling tests? I mean, if the tests don't go bad and we have the capacity to do 26 or 52 a day and we're not doing that many, are we anticipating that we will be doing many, many more at some point? And so you want to save those tests?
We are not stockpiling tests. We are taking all the recommendations coming from physicians after discussion, and we are testing every time. So we're not stockpiling. We're using the tests that we have, but we also recognize that we have limits. And so we need to be thoughtful about how we're using those. But we are not stockpiling test kits. No, we're not.
If people are hearing stories like what Seth is saying, where Seth feels like, and wherever the breakdown in communication is, Seth feels like he may have been exposed and the guidelines he was given, he worries if he had gone out into the community, if he had sent his daughters to school as was prescribed, that he could have inadvertently spread COVID-19 to a school system or other school systems, and that he's essentially not following protocol in order to keep himself self-quarantined. If people are hearing that and worrying, how would you advise us?
I would advise right now that you go to our website and read through and see what we're recommending. I would advise anyone who's not feeling well to stay home for the 14 days, particularly if they have those kinds of symptoms. If they have shortness of breath, they should definitely reach out to the hospital. If they have other symptoms that are concerning to them, reach out to their healthcare providers. That's what I would advise right now. We have a case investigation team. When there is a confirmed contact or there are other issues coming up, our contact investigation team are certainly reaching out and quickly finding out who the close contacts are. I recognize that there are people in the community who feel that they may have been in contact with someone who may have been in contact with someone else. We have a lot of people coming in saying that they are experiencing 2 to 3 degrees of separation from someone that they believe was a confirmed case. And that's where it gets really tricky. It's hard for us to track down and investigate those kinds of cases because they are often a few people out. And so we have to kind of go with the data that we have. And the data that we have right now, albeit limited because we recognize there are likely more cases than we know about, we have to go on that data right now.
That was Vermont's Deputy Health Commissioner Tracy Dolan. In fact, in a press conference yesterday, UVM Medical Center said people who may be sick with the disease but are not in severe respiratory distress or needing critical care might not get tested at all, even if it's likely they do have COVID-19. Here's infectious disease doctor Timothy Leahy at that press conference.
We're asking doctors and nurses to make judgments about how sick that person is and to figure out who really needs the testing and who is better served to stay home.
He went on to say,
the way to think about this is that early as the epidemic has evolved, what deserves a test has been changing. But now we have testing protocols that are disseminated across the network to the primary care docs, to the Department of Health. Everybody agrees on the same rules for testing, which is that if you have a travel to an area that is, you know, a hot spot, Italy, Iran, South Korea, China, and you have symptoms that are concerning, sufficiently concerning to make it so that you really need care, then you can be tested. Or if you are really fragile and have an unexplained, very severe respiratory illness, then you can get tested. And so for somebody who fits into those categories, they should reach out to their physician and get tested. And if somebody thinks they might, but they call in and they realize from their physician that they really don't quite meet the criteria, well, then that's good news.
Yesterday, Dartmouth-Hitchcock Medical Center also sent out new guidelines for patients who might be exhibiting symptoms consistent with COVID-19. The press release said, quote, if a patient does not exhibit signs that warrant an emergency department evaluation or immediate hospital admission, providers should ask the patient to don a mask and return to their home for self-quarantine and follow CDC guidelines pending further decisions on COVID-19 testing. This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. Today we're getting different perspectives on COVID-19. Yesterday was supposed to be Vermont's Disability Awareness Day in Montpelier, but the event was canceled over coronavirus concerns. So instead of being there, Sarah Launderville joined me at our studio. She's executive director of the Vermont Center for Independent Living. Launderville says people should keep a disability perspective in mind as they make preparations around the coronavirus.
You know, there are people that really depend on support workers, depend on personal care attendants to come into their home, help them move their body, help them toilet, help them get dressed and all that sort of stuff. And so there is an increased risk around that. And we're already really low on the number of attendants in our state, in our nation, really. And so those people being at risk kind of compromise how people are getting services that they require to be able to live independently.
One of the things, I wouldn't call it a silver lining, but maybe something that could be a longer-term benefit are questions around easing restrictions on things like 90 days supply of medicine, and can your insurance cover that? Are you seeing people maybe having more access to things that they've been advocating for years and haven't been able to get?
I haven't seen them being able to access it quite yet, but we do see that coming. And sort of it's almost like a joke within the disability community is that, and maybe not a joke in a ha-ha way, but that we've been fighting so hard for some of these these things to happen for so long. And it goes from medication to restrictions around doctor's visits, that sort of thing, but also accommodations and employment and having paid sick time, things that would allow people with disabilities to be able to work the same as non-disabled folks. And yeah, having that those ease of restrictions are kind of like, oh, good, we've been fighting for all this time and now some of this will happen because mainstream society is starting to see it as an issue. I'm fine with that. If that really advances the mission of the rights of folks with disabilities, then I think that that's a good thing. I would hate to see it kind of go backwards just because, you know, after the coronavirus or any other viruses are out there. But I think it's a good thing.
One of the other areas of concern is this idea that you should not stockpile, but stock up on things that you might need. And is that something that everybody is able to do?
Right. Not at all. So there's a couple of issues that come with that. One, you know, people living on Social Security benefits are not going to be able to run out and stockpile and get lots of different supplies. They're just not going to be able to. Many of them use public transportation, and just the affordability of being able to do that is not realistic. In addition, a lot of folks live in apartments and small apartments at that, and they don't have like an additional freezer that some might have or space where you can put supplies. And so there's that aspect as well. So there's a lot of issues with that sort of assumption that people can just really hunker down for at least 14 days or more in their own home and not have issues. We really need to make sure that we're communicating and accessing people who have disabilities, who have other, our elders and who have chronic conditions and might not be able to access food and supplies in the same way as others.
Can I ask you about your own life and how
Sure.
you're coping and thinking Yeah. about this? And you have a chronic condition as well Mm-hmm. that's making you, you know, particularly vulnerable to this or thinking about it?
Yeah, I got into disability rights work because I have a psychiatric disability, but over the years I've developed diabetes, I have hypertension and other underlying chronic conditions and have had cancer. And so, and you know, about a year ago lost my husband and so I'm a single mom. And so that actually also compounds sort of my anxiety and worries about how do I handle this if I contract it? And then how do I, you know, manage working with my kids and being with my children. And so then it compounds sort of the anxiety issues that I might have. And so I certainly reach out to people in that way. But I also am trying to do the best that I can to take some of the recommendations and kind of move forward around some of that, too.
How are you talking to kids about this? Because that is a big question.
Each day it's a little bit different. And so I have twin daughters who are 11 and a 10-year-old son. And so there's different types of things that they hear at school. There's different things that they see when they're able to access the news. But the conversation this morning was, you know, some kids at school are sort of making a joke about this because they don't think that they're going to contract it. And so the joke is that they cough on one another. And so I had a conversation with my daughter around how, because she's really concerned in terms of my health conditions as well, is how we're a community and that just because it's not going to affect you doesn't mean that it might not affect your neighbor, your friend. And so that was the conversation that we were having there. Also, just basically hygiene stuff.
So, Sarah, what would you like to see more of or differently in terms of the ways that as we all move about trying to figure out what's happening and how to best prepare and best mitigate, what steps could be taken that might help all different kinds of people?
The first thing I think about is in terms of the stockpiling stuff, like there are people out there, there's a new social media site that Representative Corus has started around being prepared in Vermont. And that's been really helpful in terms of people just sort of voicing their concerns. And I've seen on that site, you know, people saying that they're working with people who have chronic conditions and they can't access hand sanitizer. We hear that a lot at VCIL. And so helping people who need these supplies get those supplies. Or if you're going to the store, I know that a lot of the stores are now setting limits on what you can buy, but also just being mindful if you already have a whole bunch of Clorox wipes, leave some for the rest of us. You know, that those are important things that I think need to happen. I think businesses need to really think about their policies around working from home, allowing for paid leave, you know, if you're not a business that allows for that now, because people are going to come to work sick because there's no other way that they can survive if they don't. So we have to really make sure that we are thinking more mindfully around how we're going to help solve some of these issues overall. And it's not just about our individual needs.
And then other sort of really basic concrete steps that you mentioned that could be taken are, you know, for example, keeping in mind people who may have cognitive disabilities and making sure the signage is really clear and really simple, which would help everybody, especially as, you know, we feel anxious.
That's absolutely right. Yeah, we've done some modifying of documents, and I know Green Mountain Self-Advocates is also working on that around simple language, fourth grade reading level language, so that everybody really can access all of the different advices that's coming out. Also making sure if you're televising something to make sure that there's closed captioning so folks who are deaf or hard of hearing can access that, or providing American Sign Language interpreters when you're putting information out. So I think all of those are really important.
Do you have any concern about steps that might actually make things harder? And, you know, there are going to be things that make it harder for all of us to go about our daily lives, but that might remove the agency from people who you were talking about earlier, for example, who need things like other people to help them go about their daily business. You know, are there ways that you're concerned about the sort of civil liberties or ability of people
absolutely.
To have agency?
Yeah, I absolutely am. And I know that we're starting to see that with nursing homes, really saying that loved ones can't come and visit, and trying to really get their arms around it. And I know that that's a really difficult place, is how do we get our arms around it, make sure that people are safe around their health issues, but not doing it where folks with disabilities aren't part of that decision. And I think that that's the most important thing, that if you live in an apartment somewhere and people are saying, you know, your loved ones can't come and visit you or whatever, then it sort of starts to take away the responsibility and our independence as folks with disabilities. And so I actually think in this whole entire situation, people with disabilities have been living with these concerns all the time. And so they have a lot to give and a lot of advice, I think, that they can offer because they've been living this already. And so to make policies or decisions without including the voice of folks with that lived experience is a really bad decision in my mind. And I think that if you're in charge of an organization or a business and you're going to make decisions about other people, then you really need to be inclusive of the other people who you're making those decisions about. And I think that that's the way to really make sure that you're being mindful, and while at the same time really providing potential leadership around making sure that we're controlling what we need to control.
I assume that advice also goes for the media, but do you have specific advice for people in my field who, you know, are charged with dispensing a lot of the information?
Making sure that people with disabilities or have chronic conditions is actually just part of the messaging. I appreciate being on the show today and having that opportunity to even voice that, because I think that there are things that are coming out that really talk on a more general topic, but don't include people with disabilities, and we really need to be having those dialogues. And I think that that's important. We talked a little bit about the anxiety part of it, and I think that people are, you know, gathering as much information as they can to be informed without trying to panic. And the anxiety is growing no matter what, right? Like, or at least in our world, we see that. And so having outlets to be able to talk with one another about the reality of that anxiety, having access to like telemedicine where people can access their therapist through the phone, or there's the Vermont Peer Line where people with lived experience of psych disabilities are talking with people in the community, like having access points where people can actually talk about that anxiety and not feel like they're going to be made fun of because they're overreacting or whatever. These are real things that people are feeling right now. And so I think having that ability to talk kind of helps us be able to also remain calm enough to kind of move on to the next step.
Sarah Launderville is Executive Director of the Vermont Center for Independent Living. We spoke at 11 o'clock on Thursday. Sarah, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you very much.
This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. Today, we're hearing lots of different kinds of perspectives on how our region is responding to COVID-19, the new coronavirus. Here's how one self-employed Vermonter, a hairstylist in South Burlington, is coping with the uncertainty.
I'm Dana. I'm a hairstylist at Elan Hair Lounge on Market Street in South Burlington. We're at my station, which is one of eight in the salon. I have my equipment pretty much, most of my combs and everything are in the drawer, and then I have a blow dryer and flat iron, and my brushes are on top, Barbicide, and a leather chair.
Why don't you sit in your leather chair, and I'll sit next to you, and we'll chat.
Okay.
How long have you been working in hair?
I've been doing hair for 6 years.
And you've been doing my hair for close to 3 years,
yeah,
I think.
Yeah.
So you and I were talking the last time I got my haircut, which was a week or so ago, and I was asking you if you'd been thinking about or concerned about the new coronavirus, and you said not until recently, and then one of your clients asked you about it and actually offered a suggestion. So can you describe how you've been thinking about it in the last week or two?
Actually, the day that I saw you, a client earlier that day had recommended that I start to sell gift cards maybe during the week or two that I would be taking off work if, like, God forbid, we were, like, quarantined or anything, so that that would offset or maybe, like, spread out the amount of money that I'm bringing in. Maybe even offering a discounted gift card to even new clients just to kind of keep money flowing in. So that made sense to me. It's something I'm definitely thinking about. And it's honestly something I didn't even think about until she had mentioned it. I had no backup plan, but, you know, I am self-employed, so I have to start thinking about these things. And I've only been self-employed for 4 months, so it's, it's a lot.
How much of your income do you think you could sort of float without before you'd be really in trouble? And whether that's a percentage or, you know, how many clients, like how many cuts could you cancel before you'd be thinking, uh-oh, this is going to be a problem this month?
So if my haircuts are $42 and my rent here is $300 a week, so, you know, I'd like to ideally have, you know, enough to cover that plus some to live on, and then I have to set aside some for taxes. So at the lowest, I'd like to bring in around $800 a week in my chair and services. Thankfully, it's usually higher than that. So that, I guess that works out to like, 10 haircuts, a couple colors, like highlights. So I'd still have to have quite a few people in my chair to make it work.
Is anybody canceling on you now? Do you have any sense that it's related to this?
No, I don't have any cancellations now. But I do have a couple of people that are elderly. One client that has cancer, she's older, and I'm concerned for her.
There are two, you know, you mentioned if you had to stay home or be quarantined for one reason or another, but then there's also the flip side of other people being quarantined. There's that sort of ripple effect of not just whether you're the one who has to cancel, but whether other people might be canceling. Have you at the salon and others been talking about this at all?
It's honestly something that I feel like not a lot of people have been really concerned about. It's crazy because with hair, people will come in even if they're on their deathbed to get their hair done, which is wild. And I've definitely had people come in that were like recovering from the flu, and that puts everyone at risk. So, I mean, I don't know. I'm sure that this is going to be way more serious than that, but I just feel like there aren't too many people taking it very serious yet.
And that idea of social distancing where you're supposed to stay 3 to 6 feet away from people, not something you can do very easily if you're trying to cut and color.
No, and especially if I'm waxing people, you know, I'm touching their face. I wash my hands a lot, but still, I mean, I'm touching people's heads, you know, shampooing. I'm really, really close to about 10 clients a day. And then people also bring their children in and they're touching things. So lots of ways for germs to get around.
You should start teaching people self-waxing techniques, because I know they're probably like getting hair done. There are probably a lot of people who are like, there is no way I will go without waxing this week.
Oh my God, I wouldn't want anyone to wax their own eyebrows at home if they didn't know how. That could be like, that could be bad.
So I like this idea of gift certificates, or it's sort of, I've been thinking of it sort of like a CSA for your services, that you're sort of saying, if you can't come in this week because you're sick or I'm sick, pay me now, and it's basically an IOU. I'll give you that same service later. Have you broached that with anybody other than talking about it with me and with the woman who suggested it?
I have not. I have not talked to anyone about it yet, but I feel like if people also aren't working, then it doesn't work. I mean, I'm just going to have to, I don't know, just coast through for a couple weeks. Like, I could handle being 2 weeks off of work with the savings that I have to pay my mortgage and everything, but 2 weeks off of work while paying chair rent, I mean, that's like $600 that's going out that with no income. So, yeah, I don't know.
In terms of the level of concern you have, small concern, big concern, somewhere in between?
It's a growing concern. It totally is growing. I honestly, until the day that I saw you and then had talked to the other client, it really, like, it just seemed like such a faraway thing that it wasn't going to affect me. But I'm just realizing, like, how fast that this is spreading and how many people it's going to affect. And I'm not worried about myself, but I am worried about getting other people sick. What if I got it and passed it to one of my elderly clients? That would be a nightmare. The salon that I used to work at just sent out an email regarding steps that they're taking to just make sure that everyone is in a safe and sanitary environment. And I just heard about the email. I didn't get to actually read it, but it had me thinking, like, oh, I should, you know, maybe get some Lysol wipes and wipe things down, and maybe even leave, like, a little bit of barrier time between my appointments. So, like, 15 minutes in between appointments to just make sure everything's clean, wiped down. I mean, I do my normal, you know, barbicide. Like, I sanitize all my combs and stuff anyway. But really, it's about the chair, everything people are touching, the neck rest on the sink. So, yeah, taking a little extra time to sanitize.
Well, Dana, thanks for talking to me outside of our normal 6-week appointments. I appreciate it.
Of course. It was great. Thanks.
That was Dana Talmo, a hairstylist in South Burlington. We spoke on Wednesday.